Everyone, thanks for joining. We'll get started in just a minute, but thank you for being here. All righty. Thank you everyone for joining. We'll get kicked off and then hopefully some more people will join. This is going to be a really exciting space. We're talking about kind of the future of informal systems, our mission, our vision, and some cool things that we're working on. So thank you for coming again. This is Informal Spaces. This happens every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. In order to get reminders and recaps for the spaces, please follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to our newsletter on our website and you will get notified of any new content we have. And of course, please join us on the forum for discussion on props. Just a little bit of housekeeping ahead of time. This is not investment advice. Nothing talked about in the spaces should be taken as such. We're just talking about some interesting ideas and things that we're working on. And you can read the Informal Systems blog for more information, as well as check out our YouTube for some videos that we have. So, yeah, we'd like to get started now. Ethan, hello. How are you today? Ethan, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Loud and clear.
Good. Yes. Hi, I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm excited. We're, you know, at Informal Systems, we're planning for Q3. So lots of exciting things happening and,
yes,
you know, getting really into it.
Yeah.
I guess just to get us started, you know, we just did this yesterday at our all hands, but we like to go over and remind ourselves of what the mission and vision is for Informal Systems. And instead of like the one that's like kind of on the website, I'd like to, you know, do the exercise with you of like your own interpretation of our mission and vision.
Yeah. What's on the website? Well, what's on the website is supposed to be my interpretation, but maybe the website needs to be updated more frequently with my brainwaves. I think the way I'm looking at the website, I think it's okay. It could be improved a bit. Yeah. So, you know, we think about, I'm generally dissatisfied with the state of institutions in society, which is, you know, a pretty broad, vague thing to say, but I think a lot of people feel similarly. There's this kind of like crisis of legitimacy that people talk about. It's kind of not clear, you know, what promises our institutions are making to us or how we enforce them or how we hold them accountable to them. And this is something that, you know, has really bothered me for a long time. And it's sort of at the heart of what Informal is trying to do. And the way we've framed it right now is that we've sort of picked out three key intersecting institutions where this problem is really acute and where we feel like we can do something about it, right? And those are software, how it's built and deployed, money, how it's issued and distributed, and organizations, how they're owned and governed. And across each of these, you know, we have this problem of, you know, the promises that these institutions are supposed to make, the guarantees that they're supposed to offer us, and the challenge of how we sort of enforce them or hold them accountable, right? On software, it's, you know, what is this software supposed to do? How do we know that it doesn't have bugs? How do we know that it's respecting my privacy and that, you know, certain invariants are going to be preserved and that I can trust it, right? And who do I turn to trust it? And of course, in the blockchain space, this is, you know, increasingly relevant as there's bugs and hacks and all this stuff, and people are turning to formal traditional methods as a way to approach this problem. And that's something we have a lot of expertise in as well and have been working on, you know, both through our audit business and our product development, formal methods product development, addressing this problem of making software more reliable and trustworthy in terms of a user or a developer's ability to actually understand and declare what the software is supposed to do and verify that it behaves correctly. And then on the side of money, it's sort of a, you know, a similar thing. The monetary system is, completely corrupt in a huge number of ways and just fundamentally unsound. The science of economics, if you can even call it a science, has been an abject failure over the course of the 20th century and has completely failed to address to predict or to manage, most critical crises that have occurred in the last, let's say 100 or 150 years. And the priests of that, you know, discipline don't really seem to have any interest in doing anything about it and in overturning their models. And meanwhile, people are having, difficulty paying bills. There's a, massive accumulation of debt occurring. The monetary system is itself, fundamentally built on promises and the sort of, obligations we make to each other. But that network of debts essentially is poorly understood, poorly visualized. It's not really reasoned about as a sort of fundamental primitive. Everyone's just thinking about individual agents and rational subjective preferences and decision makings and the sort of actual structure of the monetary system in terms of the network of debts is sort of lost. And so, that's something we want to put back front and center as a way to actually reason about, okay, what is the monetary system supposed to do? What guarantees is it even supposed to offer? And how do we verify those and how do we enforce those? And we do that through, restoring a sort of network theory approach to money and finance that we call CoFi, collaborative finance, that we can get back into that raises more fundamental ways to think about the problem of how we issue and distribute money and for what it's issued and distributed. And then finally, the organizations pillar of our mission. We have software, money, and organizations. These are the three critical institutions of society we seek to transform the quality standards of by, attending to the kinds of promises they make and the guarantees they uphold. Our organizations are, they're all structured around corporate shareholderism, which is, a sort of constitutional form that was enshrined, let's say, in the middle of the 19th century, in the sort of last great, constitutional struggle, the emergence of the nation states and all this sort of stuff. And it chronically underrepresents, the key players in building organizations, which are the employees, the workforce themselves, and overemphasizes on the shareholders and on the founders and investors, largely at the expense of the people who do, most of the work and who carry the organizations forward. And so it's really important to us to restore a sort of better representation in the ownership structure and the governance structure to give employees more power. And, there's obviously lots we could say about all of this. But one thing that sort of cuts across all three of these is this new technological substrate that we feel is critical to delivering on this mission, which is the interchain itself, right? And this is where sort of Cosmos comes into all of this, is that Cosmos, the philosophy and the technology, provides the substrate for us to actually go after making these changes, because all of this, this integration of software and money and organizations, it sort of, requires a major upgrade to the internet to facilitate. The internet today is built on a certain model of software that's quite broken, and a certain model of money that's quite broken, and a certain model of organizations that are quite broken. And so we need a new internet structure and a new approach to software, money, and organizations that synthesize with that new internet structure to bring about the change we want to see. And so that's the informal mission, is basically to leverage the interchain technology as a substrate to transform the quality standards of software, how it's built and deployed, money, how it's issued and distributed, and organizations, how they're owned and govern them. If you believe in our mission, let's work together.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I always love hearing you talk about this, because I feel like it really gives us kind of like a guiding point to what all of the different things that we do within the company. We have, I think we're saying like five business units right now, and I'd like to dive into some of them and how we're using them to address kind of the issues that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. As part of our mission to transform software, we've created something called Quint.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, like you were talking about the substrate level, and I think that's really, really kind of like the foundational level in which we can start building upon all of these things. We've talked about Quint a little bit on our Twitter, and you know, we've had some of our team go and speak to the public. But for those audience members who maybe haven't heard of Quint, could you let us know like the history, where it came from, and kind of where we are now?
Yeah, well, I guess let me zoom out and just try to talk about what we're trying to do here, right? So there's a certain class of disciplines of, let's say, human endeavor that we call engineering, right? And engineering typically involves a sort of critical capacity to ensure safety and rigor, right? We do civil engineering, we do mechanical engineering, you know, I don't know, fluids engineering, aerospace engineering, all of these kinds of engineering, you know, critical engineering disciplines where, you know, the impact of failure is so high that we must have very rigorous standards for actually doing the engineering so that we can ensure, you know, that what we're building is sound and it's not going to fail or collapse in sort of unexpected ways. And we understand, you know, what we can expect to get on an elevator. You want to know what is the guarantee of how many people can be on that elevator before it's going to fail. And so you don't exceed that guarantee. Right. And I mean, I'm sure all of you have had the experience of like looking at the sign on the elevator and thinking about, you know, oh, what if I weighed 10 times the amount or whatever, like how many people can this really take? Or what if I jump, you know, all this kind of nonsense. Right. Anyways, it's a bit of a distraction. The point is, all of these engineering disciplines over the last, you know, decades have been complemented by computer programs that assist them in doing design and engineering, right? And we could call this computer-aided design, computer-aided engineering, right? All of them are computer-aided. And then we've got this other engineering discipline that calls itself an engineering discipline, but, you know, maybe it's questionable whether it deserves the title, and that is the business of developing software. And because software is, you know, at some level so cheap and easy to get started with, and you know, anyone with a computer can start writing software, it sort of feels a little bit different from, you know, aerospace engineering, which is, you know, expensive and you need to have like big mechanical things going on, right? But at the end of the day, so much software is eating the world, and so much of our society has come to depend in very fundamental, critical ways on software. And yet software as an engineering discipline hasn't developed or hasn't matured the same kind of rigor and discipline that these other engineering disciplines have, especially in terms of, and somewhat ironically, in terms of its ability to be computer assisted, right? And you might say, well, what does it mean to be for software engineering to be computer assisted? You're already using a computer. The whole thing is computer assisted. You know, you can't make software without using a compiler or some kind of programming language. And that's all true, but we want to go beyond that, right? We want to actually have the engineering process of software development be properly computer assisted. And it's kind of funny when you if you Google like, you know, computer aided software engineering, there's a Wikipedia page and it's all in the past tense. It's all like, oh, computer aided software engineering was a, you know, an approach to rigorous software engineering. And, you know, they use UML diagrams and all this stuff as if it failed, as if it wasn't something we do anymore because it didn't work. And, you know, now everyone's agile and, you know, you just move fast and break things, and as if that's a, you know, a viable way to build sustainable, maintainable systems. And so we want to do something about that, right? We want to put software engineering on solid footing. We want there to be you know, rigorous and useful and delightful tools for computer-aided software engineering. And that's coming now in the sense of, in the form of like AI, right? Everyone's using, you know, I was talking to a software developer friend. He was like, yeah, 6 months ago, I didn't think AI was shit. And now, you know, it does half my job and I use it every single day, right? And okay, that's computer-aided software engineering, but is it computer-aided design, right? We need to actually be thinking about the design of these systems, what guarantees they provide, what invariants, you know, they're going to preserve, and so on. And that's where something like Quint comes in. That's where the problem of specification comes in, right? All these other engineering disciplines, they have you know, rigorous processes of specifying the systems they're building, the properties those systems must preserve, and then using those specifications to actually evaluate and test the systems themselves, right? And that's something that's you know, it exists in software, but it's very subpar, and you know, many software developers don't have a, you know, rigorous or advanced practice of specification, and there, you know, we could argue about the reasons for that and the iterative nature of software development and all these kinds of things, but we feel there is a massive opportunity for there to be very powerful, very useful, even delightful product that allows software developers to build specifications to better understand their systems. These are tools for understanding, right? It's not like, oh, great, I have to write a specification. Like, let me go write this, you know, some markdown file or some pseudocode or, you know, a bunch of math I don't understand, whatever. It's not like that, right? This is about the problem of understanding. How do you understand the software you're building? How do you communicate that understanding? How do you onboard new people to the software so you're not left in a position that, you know, it's all just stuck in someone's head? How do you make sure you disseminate, you know, deep knowledge or understanding of a protocol so that when people ask, you know, why does this work or why is this thing designed this way, the answer isn't just like, oh, go ask Chris or go ask Dan or you know, Alice or whoever designed the thing. You actually have, you know, meaningful tools, useful tools for expressing and developing understanding yourself. And that's really what Quint is about. It's a tool for understanding. It's a tool for expressing the design of systems as a specification. So it's a language. It's a language for specifying systems that is executable. You can play with it. It's like a modern, it comes with a complete modern programming languages tool chain, but you don't use it to build programs. You use it to build specifications for understanding your programs, right? And so it's part of the software development lifecycle. But, you know, to date, a lot of specification languages have been very mathematical, very academic, very difficult to use. They haven't really been well integrated into the software development lifecycle. They're hard for sort of the average engineer, the average developer to sort of start playing with or get to know. They've got tooling that's, you know, stuck in the 90s or is just, you know, expects you to be a PhD or whatever. We want to get rid of all of that with Quint. We want Quint to be a very modern, very friendly, very delightful, you know, accessible, familiar language for the average developer to start, playing with specifications of their systems to help them, you know, understand their systems better, write better code, find bugs faster, test their systems in more advanced ways, and so on. So I should probably stop talking for a minute if there maybe make this more interactive. But, you know, I could go on a tangent about software engineering for hours. Oh, look, there's a lot of people.
I mean,
here.
I cool. love it.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, there are. And feel free. Hello. We don't want to make it, you know, like a radio show necessarily. I mean, it is kind of. But if you have any questions or, you know, you want to join in on the conversation, please feel free to raise your hand and we'd be more than happy to have you on the stage. But anyways, so, you know, we talked about Quint a little bit in like theory and like what it's supposed to accomplish. Maybe to get a little bit like more on like ground level, like our team internally, the security team does use Quint in mm-hmm. some sort of fashion. So I would love if you could like kind of explain like Quint in real life, Quint in the wild, like how we're using yeah. it, you know, without giving away secret sauce in our security business.
Yeah, well, I'll just give away the secret sauce. So Quint is a executable specification language that that makes it very fun to understand what's going on in a system, and to allow it allows you to express the understanding that you're developing in your brain in a essentially a programming context where you can play with it, where you can where you can explore the model, right? So it comes with a REPL, it comes with a simulator, it comes with a lot of type checking and other kind of checks. And so what we do in our security audit team when we're engaged to do a security audit, we will in many cases we will start developing a model in Quint of the system that we are auditing, right? And what that allows us to do is to clarify our understanding of how the protocol or the system or the architecture is supposed to work in a language that's designed for expressing that understanding. Programming languages are not designed for expressing understanding. They're designed for communicating between a human and a computer, right? For communicating from the human what the computer should do, right? And that's a problem because a big part of what you're trying to do when you're building a complex system is actually communicate with other humans about what you're trying to do. And programming languages aren't really meant for that. And we try and various ways, and you know, we build type systems and to express things better and interfaces and APIs and comments and documentation and all this stuff. But these specification languages are really about supporting the process of human understanding of what the system is doing. And so it's, you know, there have been many times that just by writing the specification just by, you know, starting with Quint and writing down what we think the system is supposed to be doing in a Quint specification, it helps already illuminate places where there are likely to be bugs that have led, you know, very quickly to finding bugs in the code, just by thinking about, you know, what the code is, what the system is supposed to do and trying to write a Quint specification. And so that's been very powerful. And you can actually play with the Quint specification. So you can, you know, it's executable. It can run, you can inspect the state. You can output traces. You can try different things. Oh, what if I add this? What if I take away this? How does the system respond? You know, a great example recently was like, one of the engineers was trying to understand IBC, something about, you know, in the IBC protocol, there are these handshakes that the chains have to do when they connect. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that has to go on there. And, you know, it's not always very well explained in the documentation or the specification, like why the protocol had to be designed like this. Right. And obviously the protocol design team, you know, years ago that when we built and designed IBC, we went through all this reasoning, like, oh, if this happens, then this happens. And then we need to do this and we need that. And so we need this thing in the protocol. And so, Gabriella, who was working on this, you know, and trying to write a spec of IBC and Quint was trying to understand something. She's like, well, why is this here? And typically the answers when people, you know, ask questions like this is like, oh, go ask Chris Goes. You know, Chris Goes designed this thing like, you know, 4 years ago. So he knows why. So if it's not in the documentation, just go ask him. Right. But with Quint, Gabriella was able to say, well, what if I just play with it? What if I just remove this thing from the protocol and then see what happens? And then very quickly she was able to discover, oh, well, then this would occur and that's bad. And I know that's bad. So that's why this feature of the protocol is needed. Right. So Quint makes it very easy to sort of play with protocols and discover why certain elements of them are necessary if that's not explained, you know, clearly in some other documentation. And so we use it in the audits, you know, very regularly to help us understand the systems we're auditing and to help even the clients understand the systems they're building. And so that you can find bugs more rapidly and highlight the actual, you know, properties or invariants the system is supposed to hold and allow the developers of the system to have a specification that they can actually play with, that they can explore. That's easier than messing with the code itself. It can be very difficult. You know, there's a lot of implementation details in the actual programming language. When you're building systems, you often, you know, can't abstract over everything for various reasons, but in a specification you can. You don't have to worry about implementation details so much because you're just focused on the specification. And then from specifications we can actually generate tests that run against the real system. And so even before we had Quint, but we were doing you know, similar sort of work, we would write, you know, there were cases where we didn't even read the code of the, you know, that we were supposed to audit. We would just write a model and then generate tests and run the tests, and the tests would shake out, you know, bugs. And so you can think about that as sort of a more advanced form of fuzzing, right? If you have a model of the system, then you can do really advanced sort of fuzzing of the system that's aware of how the system is supposed to behave. And so it's not just like a black box where you just throw randomness at it. It can actually be more intelligent about how it explores the state space of the system, which makes it more likely to be able to find, you know, complex bugs that require particular sequences, maybe long sequences of actions to actually shake out. So that's a little bit about how we actually use Quint sort of, you know, practically within the audits and how it's useful more generally. It's not something that we just want our auditors to use. We want the actual development teams to adopt it themselves and have it become part of their own software development lifecycle to facilitate onboarding and understanding and, you know, protocol design and ultimately testing as well.
Awesome. I mean, I think that, like, I'm really excited to see where Quint goes and, you know, we're working hard to get it adopted kind of across different types of teams. And if anyone's interested, please let us know, reach out to us and, maybe we can set up a Quint shop for you, where our team walks you through. And we're really excited to get more people, using Quint.
Yeah. So last week we coined the term Quint shop, which are these Quint workshops that we've started doing and offering, but Quint is very accessible. If you're listening to me on this call and you're still here and haven't hung up yet, then it means you should probably try Quint yourself. So go to github.com/informalsystems/Quint and just walk through the tutorial and you know, play around with it. Even if you're not a super advanced developer or even a developer at all, but you think about blockchains, you think about protocols, you know, you reason about things, and you read, you know, you might read documentation or you use any of you know, blockchain systems or DeFi systems, then Quint might still be for you. And so we want it to be very accessible, even beyond developers. We want it to be a tool people can use to reason about protocols in general and to understand what's going on, even if they're not developers. There's a lot of, you know, discussion and debate and conversations that happen about, you know, oh, what's a roll-up? What's an L2? What's a, you know, what does security mean? Like, you know, is this a Ponzi? Is it not a Ponzi? You know, all these kinds of things where a lot of the participants in the discussion they're not necessarily developers. They're people who understand what's going on in the space and who write about the space, but you know, maybe they're not engineers themselves, but they can contribute and unpack things. And Qwint is also designed for them to provide, you know, a language that you can play with that's a little bit more rigorous, but is still sort of accessible and at the same time very powerful, so that you can express these kinds of concepts and start to reason through, you know, how protocols work and what happens if you do this or that and so on. So we'd love to see Qwint sort of become part of that discourse as a way people express express protocols and express sort of designs and interfaces and things like that.
Yeah, I would love one day for Qwint to become a universal language that we all speak.
That'd be great. That's the dream. Yeah, from journalists to politicians to regulators to, you know, developers. Yeah, everyone's speaking Qwint. Basically, our goal is that no VC invests in a project unless there's a Qwint spec for it.
yeah. That's the
end game. I mean, it's like if there's no Qwint spec, then it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Transforming the standards, mm-hmm. right? I think that's a good segue into kind of our next part. When we talk about changing the institution of money and finance, I think that there's a lot of general dissatisfaction with how finance works, how, you know, the economy works and how money really works. Yeah. But I don't think people are able to pinpoint what's wrong with it, because it's hard to understand economics. It's hard to understand. And I think the people who are in power have created it that way, right? To make it very in the hands of a few that affects a lot. Yeah. And I think that what we're trying to do with Ko-Fi is kind of bring it back to the local level, bring it back to the communities that it actually impacts. But, again, we've talked about Ko-Fi before. There are some materials out there, but for maybe someone who's tuning in for the first time, could you describe Ko-Fi? And, you know, I know you... I love the example, and you talk about the example of 16th century merchants a lot, but maybe we switch it up and we talk about the European system after the war that worked really well. That was an implementation of, to kind of give a background for those who may not be familiar.
Yeah, that's great. So don't talk about the 16th century. Okay. So the idea behind Ko-Fi is we want to ask the question, what is money and what is money for? Right. And in the blockchain space, there's a lot of, you know, the Bitcoin was itself a response to a grand failure in the global monetary and financial system in 2008. The monetary system failed catastrophically. It never really recovered. The system that failed is you know, basically the global dollar system, also known as the euro dollar system, which basically refers to, you know, the dollars that exist offshore outside the control of the Federal Reserve. You know, most of the dollars in existence were not created in America. They were created by, you know, foreign commercial banks in a sort of, private, decentralized, private, highly decentralized, money markets, which is kind of funny, given that that's what blockchains are rebelling against. Obviously, they have, deep relationships with central banks and with nation states, and you know, the U.S. dollar is a creation of the American nation state, but the monetary system is far beyond its control. But that system of liquidity creation of offshore dollars, you know, really failed in a sort of fundamental way in 2007, 2008, and it's kind of never really recovered. And everyone's sort of spinning their wheels, you know, what to do about this. And Bitcoin shows up and is like, hey, I've got a solution. Forget about debt. You know, let's just focus on assets and on assets that are, permissionless and decentralized, and, you know, maybe privacy preserving, if we can really figure out all the cryptography for that. Let's sort of guarantee that as sort of a fundamental human right, the right to own these assets and to transact with them. And maybe that's how we can get the sort of monetary system back on track. And there's something to that. There's something important about that. But it's insufficient. It's incomplete. It's not enough to really address the fundamental problems of money. And the fundamental problem of money is really about payments. It's really about discharging debt. Right. Anytime, you know, people talk about, money is a medium of exchange. It's about exchange. It's some convenience of barter. There's an element of truth to that. But what that really misses is that even any barter or any exchange is really two actions. Right. It's not just one synchronous exchange. it's typically a, you know, two different transfers, right? One of a good and one of a, you know, a currency, let's say. And so between those two transfers, even if they're happening basically simultaneously, there is a debt, right? And actually in many cases, when you buy things, this isn't, maybe you don't have this experience as much at the retail level, but certainly at a, you know, B2B level, you buy stuff on credit, right? You, the goods are shipped and you get an invoice and you owe on the invoice in 30 days, you know, or if you work with an accountant, the accountant delivers the services and then you pay them after the fact, right? And okay, maybe if they don't trust you, you have to pay up front, but then they owe you the services, right? So one way or another, there's a debt that's created. There's an obligation that's created. And the whole point of the monetary system is to coordinate to make sure that all those debts can be discharged, right? That we don't build up too much debt. That can never be discharged because that will lead basically in some form or another to, you know, oppression or different kinds of slavery. You know, in historically, it literally, you know, if you couldn't pay your debts, you'd become enslaved. And you know, today there are different ways people are sort of crushed by crushing debt. So the whole point of a monetary system is to coordinate to ensure that debts can be discharged. And we've completely lost sight of that, right? The monetary system today, and you know, maybe for the last few hundred years, has been obsessed with the problem of the quantity of money in existence, right? There's been no real attention to the structure of the debt, the structure of the obligation network out there. It's just all about, well, we need to make sure there's enough liquidity. We need to print more reserves. We, you know, there needs to be more money sloshing around. And if we just adjust the amount of money based on, you know, abstract vague heuristics like 2% inflation or whatever, then that will work. And I mean, this is appalling, right? That people run around and pretend this is somehow like a legitimate scientific effort is really an embarrassment. You know, there's a number of things that I would be very embarrassed about on behalf of the species if this sort of alien show up. I mean, they might be here, but maybe there's some listening on this call. And so, you know, guys, I'm ashamed of the state of economic discourse. It's a complete embarrassment because none of them are even asking the right questions. It's all just sort of glossing over the problem here, right? But if we're going to have a monetary system, it needs to be tuned to this problem of how do we ensure that we can discharge debt so that we can enable commerce to keep flowing, right? And so CoFi is really all about that problem. It's all about saying, look, let's tune to the actual structure of debts in the real world. Let's look at the network of obligations. Let's move away from or complement this sort of game theory perspective and this sort of quantity perspective of the amount of money that's in existence or whatever with a network theory and a quality theory perspective about how money flows and how debts are going to be discharged. And what Isabel was getting at about you know, what happened after the Second War. So you had this sort of Bretton Woods, so Europe was completely destroyed. You had this Bretton Woods agreement where the Americans were like, look, we're going to be, we've got all the gold now. So, you know, we're going to dictate the terms of the new monetary system. Everything's going to be based on a US dollar, you know, international trade, it'll be in dollars. You need dollars for settlement, right? But no one stopped to say, well, how do we ensure there's enough dollars to actually discharge the debts that are going to be created, right? Like, okay, I want to buy something from some other country. Where am I going to get the dollars to do that? Do I have to export something to America to get the actual dollars so that I can buy something from France? Or, you know, and so no one was really asking this question. Of course, the Europeans were sort of aware of this problem. There was a competing proposal at Bretton Woods from John Maynard Keynes called Bancor. And, you know, whatever problems you might have with Keynes, he was, he at least understood this better than the other economists, which isn't saying that much, but it is to his credit. And the Bancor model was really about balancing the payments graph to ensure that debts could be discharged through a sort of balancing act, right? That if France is going to owe Germany, and maybe Germany will owe Slovenia, and Slovenia will owe France, and that can all sort of get balanced out. And so the problem isn't so much about having a reserve currency that everyone can, you know, stockpile US dollars to make sure that they can, you know, later discharge those debts. And we just sort of leave the problem of how to ensure there's enough dollars in existence up to some, you know, magical thing or don't ask too many questions about it. We actually tune to the problem of like the structure of the debts themselves, the network structure of the debts, and ensure that we kind of create balance there so that it's not about the reserves and the provision of liquidity. It's about balancing the debts and so that they're able to be discharged. But of course, you know, Keynes lost. Bangor sort of fell by the wayside. The Bretton Woods won, and the Europeans found themselves in this position of like, okay, we're trying to restart global trade, but we don't have any dollars. So, you know, what are we going to do? And so they started creating all these like, you know, bilateral relationships with each other to be like, okay, you know, we'll trade on credit for a while, and maybe, you know, France and Slovenia will have some arrangement. I'm just making up countries, but you know, so we'll trade on credit and it'll balance out, and we'll have, you know, so every country was creating these sort of bilateral relationships with all the other countries. And it was a huge, big mess. It made it very difficult for trade to get restarted again. And so at some point around, I think around 1950, they decided to set up a payments union. I believe it was called the European Payments Union, which basically tried to cut through all this bilateral monstrosity, and set up essentially a multilateral clearing union that would allow all the different countries to sort of net out their debts against each other, right? And so to reduce the need to actually have dollars, but instead allow them to take advantage of the fact that, you know, France owes Slovenia and Slovenia owes Greece and Greece owes France, then they can actually net that all out without any liquidity at all, just by doing set off sort of in a cycle. And this European Payments Union worked unbelievably well, and some attribute the sort of regrowth in Europe to the EPU more than, you know, to the Marshall Plan or to the sort of dollars that came flooding in, because no matter how many dollars come flooding in, there's sort of never going to be enough. And that's kind of been the story of, you know, post Bretton Woods of the last, you know, 50 years or so, or, you know, 70 years, whatever it is, that that there sort of it's not possible to create enough dollars to lubricate world trade, because the problem isn't the amount of dollars. The problem is the balance in the payments graph. And so the EPU was basically set up to say, okay, let's figure out how to take advantage of the balance that is there. Let's visualize the graph and look to balance it out so that we can discharge these debts, so that, you know, we can all start engaging in commerce and trade again and all grow together. And it was so successful that by 58 or so, they decided to shut it down. They didn't need it anymore because, you know, capital controls were lifting. And so now they could, you know, they could deal in dollars more. And so that was the end of the EPU, and it was deemed a success, no longer needed. And then everyone started using, stocking up on dollar reserves and using dollars. And of course, from there, the so-called euro dollar system took off and, you know, led to the disasters of, you know, neoliberalism and all the sort of stuff that followed. But so there's been, even in the 20th century, this understanding, especially in Europe, of the importance of this problem of balancing the payments graph, of visualizing the network of debts and working towards, you know, taking advantage of the structure of it to discharge debts with less money, but then also working towards balancing the graph so that you can do that more and more with less and less liquidity. And this, you know, the Americans don't seem to understand this at all, because the Americans benefit from not understanding this, because they have a, you know, entrenched, institutionalized imbalance in the payments graph that benefits them. Maybe benefits them. I mean, some people think it's also a curse, but, you know, at least some people in power there think it benefits them. And so they don't want to undo that. So the problem really isn't about, you know, the reserve currency and who's going to have the reserve currency. The problem is really one about balancing the graph and, you know, visualizing the graph so you can take advantage of the balance that's there, and then working towards there being even more balance. And that's really what Keynes' proposal with Bangor was all about, and what we're focusing on with CoFi. And so where Keynes sort of was trying to go top down and, you know, get all the world central bankers or whatever together at, you know, the Bretton Woods meeting and say, this is the plan, we should institute this at this global level. And that failed because of the sort of power dynamic. What we're trying to do is say, okay, well, maybe we can do the same thing. It's a good idea. It's not, you know, it wasn't even Keynes' idea. He took it from E.F. Schumacher, who was, you know, the guy who founded like ecological economics. But, you know, we're saying, okay, let's do this bottom up, right? Let's sort of use modern technology to make the capability available to anyone to expose the structure of the actual debts in society so that we can collaborate on reducing those debts with the least amount of money, right? Because actually getting money is expensive and difficult, and, you know, is there enough of it out there? Who even knows? No one's even asking that question. But if we can surface the debts themselves, then we can start to do something about it. We can use whatever money we do have or have access to try to discharge the most amount of debts with the least amount of money. And some debts we can discharge with no money at all. And then even with a little bit of money, we can discharge lots more debts. And we can do this in sort of a bottom-up, permissionless fashion. We can use blockchain tech. We can do it in a privacy preserving way. And we can sort of rebuild the, you know, financial institutions and, you know, payments infrastructure from this foundation of discharging debt and of tuning to the problem of, you know, the core problem of monetary system of ensuring that we can, you know, coordinate to discharge debts effectively. So that's really, you know, nice long-winded answer to what CoFi is about.
No, it's amazing. I always love that example because I think that, like, for some people, it could be like, oh, CoFi sounds like so groovy and amazing, but like, we don't know if it'll work, but it's worked for centuries and it's worked on large scale and it's worked on smaller scale. And I think that in the example that you just gave about the European Payments Union, it's a big locality, but it's still local, right? So I think it would be nice if we could hear like kind of like what you think about localism. And you've said before that like distributed ledger technologies can benefit citizens at a local level, and that'll be key to the success of a healthy and revamped financial system in the long term. So if you could get into kind of like maybe like a few things that we're working on, maybe I don't know if how detailed you want to get, but like we are now trying to implement the technologies that we've built to enable collaborative finance, embedded payments, all of that, on the local level, like what does that look like today? Like we've talked about 16th century, we've talked about the 50s, and now like today, like what would that look like?
Today, I mean, it looks like an accounts payable solution to an average business, right? So every business has accounts receivables and accounts payables. That's, you know, accounts receivables is money they're owed, and accounts payable is money that they owe to others. And, you know, they use various accounts payable solutions, bill.com or whatever, to basically, you know, manage their payables and to pay them. And CoFi would basically be, you know, from the perspective of business, it would just look like an accounts payable solution, but it would have the added benefit that their overall, you know, their debts are able to be discharged with less liquidity, right? So with less money, more debt is able to be discharged. And it works because there's many people sort of using the application and uploading their debts, and we're able to map out, you know, the network structure and take advantage of the structure and of the network to reduce the amount of liquidity that's needed to clear the debt. So that's sort of what we're building to start, is basically a system where, you know, businesses can upload their payables, so their debts to others. And, you know, if you hit some sort of minimal critical mass of businesses, then there will be chains and cycles of debts in the network, and the cycles can be cleared without any money, and the chains can be cleared with a sort of minimal amount of money, right? So if I owe Isabel and Isabel owes, Soros, then, you know, the money I use to pay Isabel can also then be used to pay Soros. And so, you know, we can clear more debt with less money, right? It's basically making the sort of money multiplier or velocity concept, you know, a structural part of how we approach payments to reduce the amount of liquidity necessary to clear more debts. But from the perspective of business, it just looks like, you know, any other kinds of like accounts payable solution where you update, you upload your bills basically. And every month you find that some of your bills have been magically reduced, and they've been offset by some of your receivables, right? And so rather than having to collect cash, you know, on your receivables in order to pay your bills, or rather than having to, you know, sell an invoice to someone else for cash to pay your bills, you can use your invoices, your receivables directly to pay your payables, to the extent that they're part of a network. And so, you know, we want to make this like really easy and accessible and connect into, you know, existing accounting systems and all that sort of good stuff. But, you know, we're going to start small and with just a sort of simple application, and we'll sort of grow from there.
Yeah. I'm excited to see that kind of launch and be used in the real world. And I think for now it's kind of like a platform or a program that like we're using within these local municipalities. But to kind of tie it back to maybe some of the work that we're doing with Cosmos, you talked earlier about how all three of the institutions that we're trying to change, interchain technology is really critical to all of that. So in the future, like how do you see CoFi leveraging like interchain security, or sorry, not security, inter-blockchain communication and the hub? Like how do you see that?
Well, it could be that it does use interchain security directly. And, you know, we're thinking about, you know, building a chain that would be secured by the hub and would provide this as sort of a, as a sort of baseline, global solution. Likely there will need to be chains in kind of each jurisdiction as well, but they can all kind of roll up into a global clearing and settlement system. So we see, the Cosmos tech and the Interchain tech as the sort of leading edge of payments infrastructure, especially, IBC and the ability to have interop between sort of different sovereign domains and to experiment with different technologies for doing payments and securing them and encrypting them and things like this. And so, because the CoFi is not just about the debts, it's also about the payments required to discharge those debts, right? And so some debts can be discharged without any liquidity at all, but that's only a small fraction of the total amount of debt out there that's in cycles. And so the rest of the debt requires liquidity to be discharged. And so a complete solution actually requires liquidity to come from somewhere. And of course, we want users to be, stewards of their own liquidity and to have self-custody and all that sort of stuff. And so blockchains are the premier way to support that kind of use case. And so we're looking at using the Cosmos technology to enable liquidity from any source basically to flow into these obligation networks and be leveraged to discharge debts. And whether that liquidity is assets owned by individuals within the network. So, I have a debt and I also have some liquidity and I can, tender my own liquidity to pay my debts, or whether that's assets from outside the network that are being lent in. So you sort of have the opportunity to connect in lending protocols and even sort of DeFi lending protocols to provide liquidity into these sort of real world obligation networks to be used to clear debt with, in ways that can actually reduce counterparty risk and credit risk, because you have exposure to sort of the whole network. And so you can take advantage of that network structure rather than just only lending to individuals. But we can also use it to enable internal forms of liquidity to emerge in the sense of new mutual credit systems, right? Where communities can basically say, hey, we actually have enough trust in our community to issue our own currency, to create our own liquidity, on our own balance sheets without depending on some external loan or external bank or something like that, to be used to settle the debts we have today and to be to have the new currency sort of extinguished over time as we do more business with each other. So mutual credit is sort of the holy grail of sort of currency creation. It symbolizes the existence of a certain level of trust within a community to be able to issue their own currency and accept it across the community. But not every community is going to be in a position to be willing to do that. And so we still want to have solution, and mutual credit doesn't necessarily scale beyond particular communities. And so we want to have solutions for, all scales and all kinds of communities to tap into whatever liquidity is available wherever it comes from, right? Whether it's a sort of people willing to make loans or offer sort of overdraft facilities to particular individuals or particular groups of individuals or entire communities, or whether you want to plug in full on DeFi protocols, or whether you just want to take advantage of the different currencies that someone might have in their own account to be able to discharge obligations. All these different sources of liquidity we want to make available to the obligation network, again, so that we can take a sort of comprehensive view of this problem of designing, a monetary and payment system that's really tuned to, how do we ensure we can discharge the debts, right? That's what it's all about. There's so much more to this than just, the current set of obligations that are due in 30 days and the payments you might make to them. There's the whole problem of, financial assets and government debts and, equity and longer term investments and all this stuff. But we have to start from sort of the fundamentals, which is, the short term debts and the sort of baseline payments infrastructure, and then work our way up to all that other stuff. Because in some sense, all that other stuff emerged from the problem of baseline payments. And so we want to sort of reconnect to that core issue of, short-term debts and the payments required to settle them. That's really what the entire banking system grew up to address. And so, if we're going to get serious, with blockchains about addressing these problems of the banking system, we have to start from the right problem space, and just holding pet rocks that are supposed to go up in value because, there's a fixed supply and they're permissionless or something is a really incomplete framing of the problem. And so we need to do a lot more than that. And that means, bringing debts on chain, restoring trust as a resource that we can leverage in building these kinds of systems, really, really thinking about payments as the sort of core problem that's what banks address. Banks are, fundamentally the payment system. And then growing from there to all these other challenges of, finance and investment and longer term horizons and things like that.
Awesome. I mean, I love seeing all of it come together, right? Because I think sometimes when we work on things, it's like we're so in the weeds that it's hard to see like the big picture. But I think that, you've created a pretty sweet vision for all of this to come together.
Well, thank you. I didn't do it alone. So,
yeah, for sure. And now that you've mentioned that you're not doing it alone, this isn't really like in the agenda, but I love being part of informal systems. And a large part of that is the way that we've structured ourselves as a co-op and also our workflow and how we communicate with each other about the promises we keep. And, informal systems as like an entity works on that in society. But, we're hiring for our security team. We're looking for an intern and we're looking to grow our team. And I think that we do a really good job of kind of figuring out who's best fit for our company. And I would love to hear, and I'm sure the audience would love to hear more about like how we at Informal Systems implement, we walk the walk of your vision of, how organizations are structured. So if we could get a little bit into that with our final 5 minutes, and I'll do a last call for anybody who wants to join the conversation, please feel free to raise your hand now. But how do you think about like the institution of organizations?
Yeah. Well, it's all about the promises we make, in the work we do, any consensual expectation is a promise, and work is doing work with other people is all about consensual expectations. And especially if there's asynchronous work, you have to expect that people are going to do things while you're not sitting next to them and monitoring them, say, and you want those expectations to be consensual. Otherwise, you're gonna run into problems. And so those are basically promises. And so you need a language for talking about promises and servicing them. And really understanding, what it is you expect of each other and are trying to do together. And at Informal, we really try to surface that, move away from the sort of like, the particular actions we're taking and really focus on the outcomes we're trying to achieve together and get to like, get to the underlying concerns about things, like what are we really trying to take care of or do in the world, and not get, too hyper-focused in the sort of low-level details, but be able to have alignment on higher-level concerns so that there's, it's possible to have more autonomy in the actual day-to-day work, but still remain aligned. So, it's always a challenge to get, groups of people to sort of gel and align and work together. But, we try to constantly surface this sort of language for talking about promises and accountability within the organization, so that there's always a, it's always sort of top of mind that we're reasoning about, what promises are we making to each other and what are we really trying to achieve together. And, that we reflect on things and that we can use language to kind of cut through, the awkwardness of talking about accountability and all that stuff. And that's, we call this language workflow, and we've got a workflow.informal.systems. We've got a whole write-up about how it works and how to use it. But of course, we're also structured as a cooperative, so it's all sort of grounded in this sort of safe corporate structure that returns voice and governance and ownership rights to the employees in a fundamental sort of legally valid way. So obviously there's less more we can say about all that, but maybe we'll open up for there's any questions, and because I'm going to have to wrap up in a few minutes.
Yeah. Does anyone have any questions or anything they'd like to ask? As a reminder, we do this every Thursday, sometimes with Ethan, sometimes with other folks on our team. We really want this to be a place for discussion or questions. So please feel free to raise your hand. Otherwise, just some reminders, you can always check out Quint and try it out for yourself. Ethan, what was the GitHub?
GitHub.com/informalsystems/Quint.
Awesome. I think we have a question. A priori, would you once you get connected, would you like to ask?
Hey, I just wanted to say hi to Ethan. Great presentation. I was actually doing a lot of backward review of all the CoFi information in the last 48 hours, so this was very helpful for me.
Oh, nice.
I just wanted to say, just share a little bit with people who are on here, and just working with you guys and the team in Austria was huge, because I really appreciated the humility that everybody showed, and also the seeking for understanding more than acting like you know what you're talking about. And I found that for me, that was a really good mental model to take away. And it's something that I've been practicing since then. So I can definitely attest to what you guys were saying.
I really appreciate that. Thanks for sharing. I hope me just talking for an hour straight on these office hours doesn't challenge that, that perspective. Yeah, we're all trying to figure this out together. And so it's nice to hear that. And there's a lot we still don't know and need to learn. But hopefully we can all figure it out together.
Awesome. Jonathan, did you have a question or anything you wanted to say?
Yeah, I saw recently that informal raised a round, which congratulations on that, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And I know you're structured as a co-op. I was just wondering if there was any difficulties with raising money while you're structured as a co-op. I know VCs care a lot about cap table. I assume you're probably not legally structured like a co-op if you were able to raise. So just wondering if there were any weirdness around that, any insights into into corporate structure, those kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's true that we are not a statutory co-op. You can read about that as well. We've written blog posts about our ownership structure. We're structured, our shareholders agreements and our bylaws and all that, is structured like a co-op, but that doesn't really matter too much from the perspective of investment. Even statutory co-ops raise external capital. And that's not necessarily a problem. We do a lot of things. And so, we heard a lot of feedback from certain investors that they just want to invest in, CoFi, but not the auditing business, or they want to invest in, formal methods product, but not the other stuff. So it was sort of the challenge was more the breadth of things we do, I think, than the particulars of the corporate structure. Because today there are so many, I guess people are sort of more used to, weird kind of corporate structurings and with tokens and all the cryptocurrency weirdness, I think investors have kind of come around to weird structures. So I think it was more the thing that was maybe more challenging for them to wrap their heads around was hey, we want to be a sustainable company. All or none on a single bet that is either going to 100x or go to zero. That's not a sustainable mode of operating. Maybe that worked for 20 years or 40 years in Silicon Valley, but it's time to change the model. And so we're going to change the model and try to build something more sort of sustainable. And we're doing a few different things and we think they can all be profitable, but we're not pursuing them the way maybe a typical Silicon Valley company would pursue certain things. So for some investors that was that was a no-go because they just want to throw money at things that are either going to 100x or go to zero, and because that's what they promised their LPs or whatever. So good for them. But there were a number of other investors that did, that joined our round, that sort of love what we're doing and believe in, our vision and our approach and the, idea of a more sustainable, sustainable pursuit of business, let's say, and even the cooperative model. So, yeah, there's still a lot to figure out in the future of how our business units are going to evolve and are they going to spin out and, what is it going to look like to raise capital in the future and things like that. But for now it seems that, it's working. The cooperative structure seems to be working so far. It's not really a day-to-day concern. It's just sort of it's a kind of baseline guarantee to the employees that, they own the company. So that sort of shifts the culture and sort of, makes it very clear fundamentally that as the CEO, I'm performing for them, not just for not just for, you know, external investors or for the shareholders or for myself, but the employee interests are sort of really represented in the structure of the company. But that doesn't, you know, there's still the possibility for, you know, the usual tensions. There's still, you know, hierarchy and things like that. It's just we try to sort of ground everything in a more in a kind of, I don't know, deeper understanding of what a company is, what an organization is. And it all really comes down to, you know, across all of these institutions, the promises that we make, right? And so, you know, from our perspective, what does hierarchy mean? It means that you're either making broader or longer term promises, right? There's certainly, you know, the thing we haven't really talked about too much today is power. And across all of these institutions, power plays a big role. And you know, that's also something economics does. It just sort of assumes away power or tries to justify, you know, the inequalities that exist as coming from sort of non-power sources like performance or whatever. So power is a real thing, but you need to be able to like visualize the structure of the network to even start to really, at least, you know, I have this hypothesis that visualizing the structure of the network can help us go after the problems of power maybe a little bit more, I don't know, methodologically or systematically or something like that. So anyway, in terms of the organization, you know, we think about we don't want there to be some kind of like tyranny of structurelessness. So it's not just like, oh, it's a completely flat organization and, you know, there's no hierarchy or anything like that. But we try to derive the actual structure of the organization from the structure of promises that people are making, right? And that's what the workflow language sort of helps us. Sorry, I'm sort of derailing from your question about investors and co-ops, but it sounded like it was sort of a more general question of like, you know, learnings about organizational structure. And I think really tuning to the promises people are making in the organization and is really the key point to think about. And, you know, making sure you have alignment with investors and with employees on what you're trying to do in the world, right? What promises are you really making to each other? And at the end of the day, you know, if you're building a Delaware C Corp, you're just promising to increase the share price. That's it. That's like the fundamental promise, and everything is built around that. And that's not the promise we're making. That's not the main thing we're trying to do. We're trying to do something, you know, bigger and broader. And we want it to work as a model that others can kind of adopt and utilize as well. So that's probably still a ways out, but yeah, that's how we think about things.
That was very interesting. Colin Drum has this like super fascinating theory of power where it construes power as like options or optionality. Mm-hmm. I really like that. But I actually just wanted to ask one follow-up question about something you said. Which fascinated me was, do you think it's feasible for venture investment to coexist with sustainable business models? Because obviously you don't have those like 100x results. And in my head, I still think there should be some room for investing in like moonshots or experimentation or like being able to, as a society, invest in like risky ventures.
Yeah, but definitely.
Also, like, really believe in the sustainable business model. It's something I really admire about Informal. So just wondering on your thoughts there.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, investing in risky things is like an ancient phenomenon, I guess, started with like, you know, ships and journeys, though there was a lot of like plundering and stuff involved there. But, you know, the like dominant model we have of Silicon Valley is a low interest rate phenomenon, right? Like the last 20 years, the defining feature was that interest rates were low. And the entire VC complex seems to have grown up in that environment. And I think it's in for a real reckoning. And so I do think there's still, you know, a reasonable, opportunity for venture capital. And I think it can exist with sort of sustainable models, but I think the whole structure needs to adapt. And it would be good to see VCs like more actively support more sustainable forms of investment. I mean, it's not obvious to me that the only way that VC can work is that, you know, they only invest in things that are going to go 100x or zero. That doesn't, you know, that's not the society I want to sign up for, that those are the only businesses that get funded. So, something about that needs to change. And, you know, probably we will find that there will be, there's a lot of opportunities to invest in things that, you know, are, might go 10x or, you know, half or something, right? Rather than 100x or zero. Like, so I think there's a lot of opportunities for new, for different and more sustainable models. And there are investors out there that are experimenting with those kinds of things or trying to standardize those kinds of approaches. And so I'd love to see more of that and, you know, more sort of responsible structuring and engagement from investors. Not all investors are cut from the same cloth. Obviously, there's a huge amount of variety and diversity out there. And there's definitely a lot of like really thoughtful, good people who are thinking about the problem, but many of them are also constrained by their, you know, LP agreements. And there's only so much you can do about that, right? So I'm not gonna fault them for that. But yeah, I think definitely, you know, more support for cooperatives and more cooperative models, I think, is also pretty key. But to be honest, I don't have it all sorted out yet. I mean, I don't know exactly what the right model is. I mean, we're talking about restructuring capitalism at some level. And, you know, we've had, I don't know, a few different eras of capitalism. Maybe we're entering the third. I mean, it depends how, you know, you can structure this. You can talk about this a million different ways, but I think we're on the cusp of you know, some kind of large scale constitutional reform that's over the next few decades, that's going to change, you know, a lot of these sorts of things. And I think it's really important that co-ops, worker co-ops especially, come out as a sort of major winner in all of that, because I think that's a really important a structural thing. We can get into why maybe another time, because I do have to get going. But yeah.
Hopefully, Jonathan, that answers your question, and we'd love to have you back on at another time. I think this is a really interesting topic. Jim, Nick, I saw your question in the replies, but we're a little bit over time, so we will have another episode on Ko-Fi, so please come through to that, and we'd be more than happy to answer your question. And I'll link you the Twitter spaces that we did that might answer some of your questions. But again, thank you everyone so much for joining, and Ethan, thank you as always for your time, and we will see you next week.
You got it. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ants dragging out the max amount of payments, red down pay. Got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss. And I'm liking the odds, fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, yo, the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary fall. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of DNA stacked in non-toxic just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like the shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the coat and going full throttle. Eats, tearing apart your community. All these low-hanging fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10, stargazing after the siege. Commanding all the management to grab a few seats, and then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats, and if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served.
spaces.